I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to John P. McCormick, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. We're discussing his 2018 book, Reading Machiavelli, Scandalous Books, Suspect Engagements, and the Virtue of Populist Politics from Princeton University Press. McCormick works on political thought in Renaissance Florence, 19th and 20th century continental political theory, and contemporary democratic theory. His books include Machiavellian Democracy, Weber, Habermas, and the Transformations of the European State, and Carl Schmitt's Critique of Liberalism. So first of all, let me say it's an absolute delight, John McCormick, to have you on the Political Theory Review.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeff. Thank you for the invitation.
So, John, I love the book. I sort of saw it, and you can tell me if this is wrong, but a kind of extension of your seminal book, Machiavellian Democracy, that provides more evidence from the core text, the prints, the discourses above all, and critiques some big alternative interpretations of Machiavelli. Do you see it in that way, as a kind of extension of your seminal work and sort of moving a little bit beyond it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the book is in two parts. And so part one deals with, there's a chapter devoted to each of Machiavelli's major works, The Prince, The Discourses, and The Florentine Histories. And what I wanted to do with those chapters was kind of fill in holes or fill in blanks that I left behind when I did Machiavellian Democracy. Machiavellian Democracy was very much about domestic politics, about class politics, constitutionalism. It was very much about the politics of class and class conflict. And one of the things I wasn't able to deal with extensively there was socioeconomic issues, the issue of social policy. How do you maintain the equality necessary to have political equality? And so in the discourses chapter here, I was able to go into greater depth about Machiavelli's views on how political liberty depends on economic equality. So I was able to flesh that out more fully. The first chapter on the prince and on kind of religious allegory in the prince allowed me to deal with a text that I could only deal in a cursory manner in Machiavellian Democracy. Machiavellian Democracy was very much focused on the discourses to the neglect of the prince. And so being able to devote a whole chapter to the prince and my reading of how popular judgment, the view of the vulgar, as Machiavelli calls it in The Prince, relates to the kind of democratic politics I see elaborated in the discourses. And then the third chapter of part one, which deals with the Florentine histories, it was an opportunity to kind of enter a debate. There's kind of a consensus now that Machiavelli's later writings became more conservative. I mean, whether you think he's as much of a Democrat as I do in his younger days, almost everybody thinks he became more conservative. And so I was able to kind of devote a whole chapter to the Florentine histories and kind of show the rhetorical strategies there that Machiavelli's kind of revealing that he still very much agrees with his previous works, and he still very much adheres to a democratic standard for republicanism, that he hasn't gone over to an aristocratic or an oligarchic view of republicanism. So in that way, yeah, very much part one was about trying to shore up or extend arguments for Machiavellian Democracy and apply them in new ways.
Yeah, and so I tend to start by asking what the motivation for the book was. So what was it motivated by, a desire to sort of complete Machiavellian Democracy then, or so why the second book on Machiavelli?
Yeah, very much so. I thought I had left things like economic equality. I had left that undeveloped. I had not addressed, this literature saying that the late Machiavelli had become basically an aristocratic republican, and I felt like I had neglected the prince. So that was one. So I wanted to kind of project an interpretation of Machiavelli as a Democrat that built on Machiavellian Democracy. But I also wanted to, in part two, I wanted to really address what I thought were misinterpretations of Machiavelli. And so part of the book was setting forth my own or extending my own interpretation, and part two was the attempt to refute what I thought were erroneous, misguided, or even duplicitous interpretations of Machiavelli. And in particular, you know, there are the Machiavelli interpretation field is a bloody battlefield. in particular, the adversaries I chose for part three all see Machiavelli as a Republican, and so it's I'm not fighting the fight of, oh, Machiavelli was an advocate of tyranny, or Machiavelli was a you know, there's some great contradiction between the prince and the discourses. You know, I'm kind of fighting a civil war here, because the authors in part two, Rousseau, the Cambridge School, mainly Quentin Skinner and John Pocock, and Leo Strauss, in a more idiosyncratic way, all concede that Machiavelli is a Republican. The question for them is, what kind of Republican? And I see them all as kind of reading him in a overly aristocratic and oligarchic way, a way that kind of elevates a view of Republican politics where the few, the best men, the wealthy, the nobles are the ones who must take precedence in a republic for it to survive. And they must really suppress or manipulate or at least outweigh the people in republics. And so I really wanted to take this as a kind of fraternal battle. You know, I'm not fighting people who think Machiavelli is a monarchist or a pro-tyrannical author. I'm fighting authors who think of him as a Republican. I just think that they're turning into the wrong kind of turning him into the wrong kind of Republican.
Yeah, I found that very useful. I mean, we tend to think of, you know, Republicanism as one monolith, you know, homogenous thing. And one of the things your book is very helpful to remind us that it's there's no single Atlantic Republican tradition. There's just sort of multiple ways that Republicanism can become manifest. So I found that really useful.
Exactly.
Let me start by asking you about the book is called Reading Machiavelli, and so one of the things that the sort of themes that you take up in the book is how to read Machiavelli and attending to his distinctive mode of writing, which for any of us who've read Machiavelli for any length of time, he sees a very, very tricky, very interesting, very, very compelling writer. You say, I wanted to ask you about a quote, which is on page 8 in your book. You say, his mode of writing creates an environment in which readers participate in the vibrant intellectual sensory habitus of his books, in much the same way as he encourages the citizens of republics and even the subjects of principalities to do. How do you see his distinctive mode of writing sort of, you know, contributing to the broader sort of republican argument that he makes?
Well, I think, you know, I think he stimulates readers to be critical. So there's a kind of subjective and objective part of that strategy. I think the easy part is to show that Machiavelli objectively is demonstrating throughout all his works that the common people, the vulgar, as he calls them in The Prince, or the plebs, as he calls them in The Discourses, they should be the ultimate arbiter of truth. And I think that's demonstrated throughout all of his works. And a lot of what I do in the book is to show how he demonstrates that in all his works. But then there's this subjective element where I think that the reader himself, whether, you know, a noble or a member of the vulgar, is kind of stimulated to a kind of critical thinking that enables them to think about politics in a new way. And so just to give an example from each of the first three chapters, the chapters of part one. So I think a lot of people who've read The Prince know that Machiavelli says in a central chapter, you know, the only people who judge the world are the vulgar, and that the few should not be the ones whose judgment counts. It should be the vulgar. And then he makes this claim that, and in the world, there is none but the vulgar. And so I take that to mean, and I think he elaborates this elsewhere, you know, that there's a group of people who think that they're not vulgar and who think that they're particularly prescient or particularly prudent, and that they're separated from the people, Machiavelli's writings are constantly showing, again, both objectively through examples, but also subjectively, he takes you on a road where he shows you that you don't actually know what you think you know, or the conclusions you're drawing from my work are really only provisional. And once I've lured you into a provisional conclusion, let me undermine it and show you that you were wrong in the first place. And so I think that's a kind of writing that disabuses the arrogant of their complacency and their kind of haughty disposition toward politics. And it also encourages those who are not arrogant to kind of fortify themselves and gain confidence as they follow Machiavelli through a lot of twists and turns. And I'm speaking very abstractly here, so let me talk about concrete examples. So, for instance, there is that chapter on the vulgar and the judgment of the vulgar in the center of Machiavelli's Prince. But the chapter where the vulgar play the most prominent role is Machiavelli's chapter devoted to the career of Cesare Borgia. And Machiavelli twice, he really wants to emphasize the fact that Cesare Borgia is called Duke Valentino, and in reality, we know historically, he's called Duke Valentino out of some deal that the French king and the Pope, Cesare Borgia's father, came to that gave Cesare a title, Duke Valentino. But Machiavelli makes it a point to say twice that Cesare Borgia, or as the vulgar call him, Duke Valentino. And then he himself proceeds in the course of describing Cesare Borgia's career to exclusively call him the Duke. And so in doing so, Machiavelli is showing his reader, I'm taking on the standpoint of the vulgar. It's the vulgar who call him Duke Valentino. And so I too will call him Duke Valentino. And throughout Cesare Borgia's rise, Machiavelli calls him the Duke. He admires all of the things he's done, horrible and glorious. And it's really only until the Duke falls or fails to measure up to what Machiavelli says he should have done that Machiavelli resumes calling him Cesare Borgia. And so I think there's a guide there to Machiavelli wanting us to take, whether we or not we already have the disposition of the people, to take on the disposition of the people and to look at a political leader like Cesare Borgia through the eyes of the people, which of course accords with Machiavelli's dedicatory letter in The Prince, where he says, you know, I'm looking at you, the prince, from the valley, from a low point, and I can see you and I can understand you in a certain way that you can't understand me. And so I think Machiavelli throughout The Prince is telling us that the viewpoint of the vulgar is very important. And he's actually demonstrating that, performing that, if you will, rather than just declaring you should take the standpoint of the vulgar.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, if in chapter two on the discourses, Machiavelli writes in such a way that you could interpret him as either favoring or criticizing the redistributive agenda of the Gracchi brothers in Rome. You know, there's a kind of straight, superficial reading that accords with the aristocratic republican tradition that says, you know, the Gracchi really overstepped their bounds by trying to redistribute wealth in the Roman Republic, and that caused tumults or scandals that led to the Civil War and the collapse of the Republic. But Machiavelli actually writes in such a way that if you follow him carefully, he actually winds up endorsing the Gracchi's redistributive agenda, and that it's not the Gracchi who are at fault for the Roman Republic's fall. It's the aristocrats, it's the Senate's fault for refusing to go along with their redistributive agenda, which would have saved their own position of prominence and the Republic itself by just restoring it to some level of relative equality. And so there's a kind of rhetorical strategy Machiavelli engages there. I think he thinks he will never get the kind of intransigent oligarchic Republican to take a favorable view of the Gracchi. But there must be some persuadable nobles or some persuadable aristocratic Republicans who will see, who are open to this kind of teaching he's doing, to say, oh, okay, maybe it wouldn't have been such a bad thing to go along with the Gracchi and to endorse these kinds of reforms compared to what came later, Caesarism, etc.
Yeah, that's. I was curious about, I mean, I think you're suggesting there sort of why he engages in this distinctive kind of mode of writing. You know, why not just come out and say, hey, I'm going to occupy the position of the people? I mean, is the idea that, I mean, he's writing to an aristocratic audience, perhaps. He's writing to a group of people who have a sort of aristocratic leaning or oligarchic leaning. The history of political thought up to him is rather aristocratic in orientation. So he needs to be a little bit more careful and circumspect and in sort of shifting his readers, even maybe unconsciously in that direction.
Absolutely. And that plays itself most dramatically in the Florentine histories. And chapter three is devoted to the rhetorical strategy where Machiavelli really is, one hates to attribute to an author as saying the opposite of, or meaning the opposite of what he says, but that comes the closest to being the case in the Florentine histories. So, you know, these interpreters who say Machiavelli became more conservative have a lot of evidence to go on at the surface level of the Florentine histories. He seems very critical of the common people of Florence and laudatory of the Florentine nobles. He seems to really disapprove of the Trompi revolt, this proletarian revolution in Florence, and it seems like Machiavelli is really walking back all of his endorsement of the people versus the nobles in his other writings, in both The Prince and The Discourses. And so what I do in chapter three is to kind of explore or trace out this rhetorical strategy where Machiavelli sets his adjectives in complete contrast to his verbs, if I can be so crude, that his evaluative statements consistently when it comes to class politics in the Florentine histories, his evaluative statements are consistently and comprehensively undermined by the facts he describes going on the ground. So, for instance, very famously, probably the most famous quote from the Florentine histories comes from the opening of Book Three, where Machiavelli criticizes the Florentine people for being different from the Roman people because the Roman people were willing to share offices with the Roman nobles, whereas the Florentine people wanted to hoard offices exclusively for themselves, and in doing so, they deprived Florence of the military valor of the Florentine nobles. Now, you read that and you say, oh, wow, well, that's a wholesale repudiation of Machiavelli's earlier views. But just a few paragraphs before that, at the very end of chapter two, Machiavelli demonstrates how the Florentine people, after they conspired with the Florentine nobles to overthrow the tyranny of the Duke of Athens, they opened up the offices of the Republic to the nobles again and said, look, you know, we're in this together. We've overthrown tyranny together. You guys deserve to hold offices again. And the nobles then start a civil war where they try to exclude representatives of the people from holding any offices at all. And so when you take a fact like that and you juxtapose it to an evaluation like Machiavelli gives just a few paragraphs later, you have to ask yourself, what's going on there? Moreover, this claim that the Florentine nobles were so valorous and were filled with such generosity in a military sense is belied consistently through the previous book, through Book Two, where the nobles are actually cowards. They don't show up to fight for each other against the people. They make incredible misjudgments of military strategy or what have you. And so those two incidents became for me clues that, okay, Machiavelli's ultimate evaluations are not where the story really is in the Florentine histories. The story's in the action. And if the action corresponds to what he was saying in The Prince or The Discourses, then we know that's what he's really trying to show. And so I think that there's a kind of way of winning over a certain aristocratic audience that's open to being educated. It will just placate the inveterate aristocratic partisan, but it may bring along the more persuasive, the more moderate aristocratic reader.
Yeah, the one thing that occurs to me, I mean, first of all, I should say your readings are extremely penetrating and interesting. One of the things that occurs to me more generally is the influence of Machiavelli. Say, maybe, I mean, one of the things that you emphasize in the Cambridge School chapter is how the Republican tradition after Machiavelli didn't follow Machiavelli's advice all that well. So maybe he was too careful in his writing.
I think that's true. It's interesting you choose the Cambridge School scholars, because I think, yeah, in a sense there, he was too subtle for people like Pocock and Skinner, who, you know, very much want to read him straight and are predisposed to think of him in continuity with previous republicanisms. And so it's very easy, particularly for Quentin Skinner, to say, oh, look, you know, there's not much difference between Cicero and Machiavelli, you know, if we just look at a very kind of abstract level. But I think in the case of my other two interlocutors in part two, Rousseau and Strauss, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. I think they saw the radical democratic element in Machiavelli, and that in Rousseau's case, he did his best to just completely repudiate it and give an alternative model that was even more, if you can imagine, more aristocratic than the aristocratic republicans Machiavelli was arguing against, whether Cicero or Guicciardini, or who came before Rousseau, like Harrington. So Rousseau really, I think, quite alarmed at Machiavelli's democratic republic, really constructed a completely alternative, highly oligarchic republican model for large republics that he deliberately wanted to supplant or make impossible that you could appropriate Machiavelli for modern republicanism. And then in the case of Strauss, I think, you know, Strauss has this, enormous love-hate with Machiavelli. He admires his daring, the quality of his mind, his philosophical sophistication and depth. But on the other hand, he either believes Machiavelli is just wrong in advocating the people as a standpoint of judgment and democratic republics where the people actually do participate and rule, that Machiavelli was wrong to make those judgments, or I think to satisfy himself, he creates this story or this interpretation where he didn't mean what he said. And then Strauss goes to great hermeneutic gymnastics to show that Machiavelli really didn't mean what he said when it came to democratic republics and to popular judgment. So I think, you know, readers like Rousseau and Strauss are pretty sharp. They're pretty sharp readers of Machiavelli. They saw the radical democracy there. I think readers like Pocock and Skinner wanted to, in advance, admirably, because they really wanted to separate Machiavelli from the tyranny charge. So they wanted to say, look, he's a good conventional Republican. And in freeing him from the tyranny charge, they also expunged kind of the democratic radicalness, you know, in trying to expunge the autocratic radicalness, they also expunged the democratic radicalness.
Yeah, good. So I thought we could maybe back up and just talk generally about the sort of basic case that you make for Machiavellian democracy. So this might implicate your earlier book too, but I guess at the most basic level, you know, the question is, why should we think? I mean, Machiavelli has long been taken, you know, as a kind of this view has been debunked, but as a kind of friend to tyrants. You know, some think he's, you know, in contrast to that, a kind of more of a forerunner of liberalism. And you make this innovative case that he's a kind of radical Democrat, and you pay attention to a lot of the institutional design in the discourses, which is quite interesting. There's this sort of public trials against the aristocrats, the restrictions on wealth and some of the popular assemblies. I thought we could maybe think about like this sort of basic case that Machiavelli makes about human nature. So he has this very famous line in chapter 9 of The Prince about the two humors, mm-hmm. and that the few desire to oppress and the many desire not to be oppressed. I was always sort of curious about that line. I mean, first of all, does that seems to be a kind of cornerstone of your view. And I mean, what do you make of his use of the term humors in chapter 9? I mean, do you think of these as kind of like natural kinds that the few and the many are sort of just naturally different, or are they, you know, are there basic desires sort of manifested from a more basic social structure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you put your finger on the problem there. I mean, in a sense, because the humors, look, it's a naturalistic term, but it only comes to the form in collective settings, right? And so we tend to think of naturalism as kind of individually based. And I don't think Machiavelli thinks that individuals, you know, from a particular social class we can determine whether they have a humor to oppress or not to oppress. It's just that the nobles or the grandi or the aristocrats together create a humor which is naturalistic to oppress, and the people gathered together, the common people, the poor, the plebeians, the populo, have a collective desire not to be oppressed. And that's very much the cornerstone of Machiavelli's Democratic Republic and the cornerstone of Machiavellian democracy. And that, so really, if that's the case, if collectively the nobles want to oppress and the people want not to oppress, then Machiavelli is saying, well, surprise, surprise, I want to reinterpret the history of Republican constitutionalism, which has empowered the few over the many in the hope or the expectation or the belief that the few actually are the ones who best have the common good at heart and understand how to realize it. And Machiavelli really takes, you know, he de-Aristotelianizes and de-Ciceronianizes the definition of nobility to say, no, it's not honestum that defines the nobility. It's their desire to oppress. And so there is no distinction between aristocrats and oligarchs. They are just oligarchs. And in chapter 9, you mentioned quite presciently from the prince, in chapter 9, Machiavelli takes that word, takes the Italian word, the Italian version of honestum, which Cicero applied to the nobles, honestum defined as justice or decency or honor. And he takes the Italian word onestà, and applies it to the people. It's the people who have onestà. It's the people who have decency. It's the people who otherwise would not engage in oppression, except when they're oppressed. I mean, Machiavelli doesn't say that people are incapable of oppression. They can oppress, but they have to be instigated into doing so, whereas the nobles do so naturally. And so when you reverse the political psychology, or you reverse the political sociology of cities, as Machiavelli does, not only in The Prince, Chapter 9, as you say, but also in Chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Book 1 of the Discourses, when you do that, then you can justify very different arrangements. You can justify arrangements where, you know, senates or aristocratic bodies are not the predominant institutions, but you can now claim that popular assemblies should be the ultimate judge of the truth, as Machiavelli says, that the ultimate decisions should be made in popular assemblies, that free speech in cantiones, in deliberative assemblies should run free, that people can propose and criticize and debate over law, that's something they can and should do, which a lot of aristocrats like Guicciardini or Rousseau want to prevent. And also, you know, this other element of Machiavelli's republicanism, this tribunes of the people, this institution of a magistracy that the nobles are not eligible for, that only poor citizens are eligible to hold this office, that has tremendous veto power over senates and over executive officers, that have the power to of habeas corpus to kind of free common citizens who have been arrested or abused by political or economic elites, who get to propose laws in the popular assemblies. Machiavelli is a lot less afraid of that office, whereas you read you read Cicero or you read Rousseau, and you think the tribunes of the plebs or the guicciardini, that they're the worst institution that were ever created in the history of constitutions. And finally, as you know, you mentioned, political punishment must be in the hands of the many and not the few. That political trials, like, you know, like the one that convicted Socrates and like the one that convicted Coriolanus in Athens and Rome, are, you know, the ultimate deterrent and the ultimate way of meting out just outcomes when it comes to political crimes. And that it's a very hard sell, because aristocrats seem to think that they're going to fare badly if they're tried, if judgment before the common people is made. But you know, Machiavelli throughout his works is always saying, look, committees of small aristocrats who try each other, either, you know, too consistently let the guilty off and convict the innocent. That's where, you know, you get false positives and false negatives is in these aristocratic bodies that try people. That really you'll get the best outcome. You'll get the most correct and the best deterring outcome if you allow popular assemblies to try political trials. So those institutions, you know, lawmaking in popular assemblies, deliberation of popular assemblies, tribunes of the plebs with veto power, and popularly judged political trials, those all derive from this theory of the humors that Machiavelli sets out, that it really is the people who can be trusted to be the guardians of liberty, as he calls them, because they have an appetite or humor not to be oppressed rather than to oppress, as the nobles do.
Yeah, just as an aside, sometimes in my more democratic populist moments, I wonder if it's sort of like financial crisis of 2008 would have gone quite differently if we didn't have more of a, you know, quote, aristocratic regulatory body against the financial system, and we maybe had more plebiscitary regulation or punishment meted out. There was very little punishment meted out of in the wake of that crisis.
Well, that's very much what motivated me.
Oh, you okay.
Know, I think in, you know, particularly the second Iraq War and the financial crisis were events that I think I would have written a more mild rendering of Machiavelli's democratic and populist disposition had it not been for my own experience under Iraq II and the financial crisis, because I think I really felt Machiavelli kind of laughing in a mocking but a kind of sympathetic way at the United States, that, you know, you're not a free people. If you would let people like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney get away, let alone go to jail, you would let them get away with their lives for expending that kind of blood and treasure in a mendacious military adventure. You're not a free people. A free people doesn't do that. No ancient republic would have let Bush or Cheney go unexiled, unimprisoned, or unexecuted. That's just the rules of the game of a free people. And similarly with the financial crisis, the idea that, you know, bankers didn't wind up in jail for really such kind of reckless behavior that ruins the lives of ordinary people is really just a sign of a real lack of freedom, and that, you know, liberal democracy really provides a blank check to elites in a way that a Machiavellian democracy would not. So you've put your finger on something important there. You know, Machiavelli thought that punishment was severe punishment, of course, was a fundamental aspect of a free republic.
Yeah, so to return to Machiavelli, I had maybe I'll ask you about an alternative interpretation that you don't talk about in the book. So this isn't really fair, but I had Catherine Zuckert on. She was the first guest, actually, of all. Mm-hmm. And so her book on Machiavelli sort of defends a, maybe we say a sort of bourgeois liberal Machiavelli, a kind of forerunner of liberalism, forerunner of Locke, that places emphasis, a lot of the sort of Republican institutions that you talk about. So she reads as in the tradition of the liberal tendency towards establishing checks and balances and the rule of law and stability and the protection of property, especially, right? Does it, you know, Machiavelli and the Prince talks about, you know, the people forget the death of their father before they forget the loss of property, that these are the sort of the tendencies that the elements of a good republic that Machiavelli's pointing towards. And so the kind of institutions I think that you talk about are sort of part of the tumults, that the competition, the conflict between the few and the many that are part of the checks and balances, and that Machiavelli also points towards, you know, the limitations of the people, the license that the people is prone to. So how do you sort of stand towards that kind of reading of the sort of more bourgeois, I guess, liberal Machiavelli that emphasizes the limitations of the people rather than its potential?
Right. Well, I would say, you know, Zuckert's book is in a tradition very much indebted to Leo Strauss's work, where Machiavelli is not read on his own or read as much with other Republicans that came before him. He's read very much in light of the liberalism that came after him, and so he's kind of domesticated as a step in the development of liberalism. And I think that does him a disservice, because it really defangs him. It really it takes the kind of the radical populism out of his work. I mean, seeing him as a forerunner of Hobbes or Locke or Mill really underestimates how, you know, how illiberal Machiavelli is. I mean, just talking about the kind of political trials we're talking about, where, you know, that don't meet the standards of due process and equal protection that liberalisms would want. You know, when I talk about political trials for, you know, on the basis of Machiavelli, liberals go crazy. Like, that's, you know, you can't have that. That's just not, that's incompatible with freedom. And, you know, and I counter, no, Machiavelli freedom, it's the only way to guarantee freedom is to treat those with disproportionately high amount of power and wealth with disproportionate severity. So I think, you know, going forward, there's that problem of kind of reading back liberalism into Machiavelli. And there's also a kind of miscomparison, a miscontrast. You know, the Straussian interpretation very much wants to read Machiavelli in light of Plato and Xenophon when they look back, but they don't really look very carefully at the difference between Machiavelli and Cicero, and Machiavelli and Guicciardini, this kind of Italian tradition, this Italian aristocratic tradition of republicanism that really highlights how populist Machiavelli is in comparison to standard republicanism. So I think it misses a lot. I mean, I think there's a kind of, in the Straussian literature, and I show how this is true of Strauss in chapter six, that, you know, Straussians really tend to cherry pick Machiavelli's criticisms of the people and moments of misjudgment on the part of the people, and they just completely give a free pass to the nobles and senates in his writings. They don't acknowledge the fact that Machiavelli's harshest criticisms of judgment are of three senates in particular: the Senate of Venice, the Senate of Sparta, and the Senate of Carthage. And that in the latter case, in the case of the Senate of Carthage, they brought about the destruction of their own civilization for failing to sue for peace with Rome after their victory at Cannae. And you can just never read that in the Straussian literature. It's always, oh, look how Machiavelli criticizes the people for saying, you know, for misjudging in this case or that case, but they constantly giving a pass to the nobles. So there's a very selective reading of class politics that students of Strauss undertake when they engage Machiavelli.
Right. I suppose one could say, you know, you could revise that reading, synthesize the Straussian and McCormickian readings and say, the aristocrats are bad, but the people can also be bad, right? And yeah, so that's why we need the rule of law.
Well, the rule of Machiavelli is a rule of law thinker, but not a rule of law thinker in the sense of a, you know, post 18th century liberalism. I mean, he considered himself. I mean, these political trials are not pogroms, they're not purges. They're you know, procedurally correct. They follow an established process. But I think liberals would disagree with the process itself. So I think. Yeah, I mean, that way, that reconciling the McCormick and the Strauss is another way of saying, oh, Machiavelli is an advocate of mixed regimes.
Right, right.
And I think, and you get a lot of that in the Cambridge school. So that's what Pocock and Skinner would say. Look, he's a staunch advocate of mixed regimes. But again, when you do that, you ignore or you elide how Machiavelli mixes the regimes. He mixes them in such a way that the popular element is given tremendous ascendance over the aristocratic element, such that it's mixed in so predominantly for the people. That's why I chose to call him a Democrat. It's a mixed regime. Yes, there's a Senate, but it's basically an Athenian structure on which you impose a Senate. And his only argument for a Senate is not because you collect the wise and most common good oriented citizens in one place. He says you need a Senate just to keep the rich from having oligarchic coups more often than they otherwise would launch against a popular government. It's a completely expediency-based argument about why you have Senates. You have Senates to try to enlist temporary allegiance from elites, not because they're any better at judgment than the people. And also, you know, this is another element of Machiavelli, one that even makes me uncomfortable. When the time comes to overthrow a corrupt republic where senates have too much power, you have them all in one place so you can kill them. That's not a traditional mixed regime defense of a senate. So you know, mixed, yes, mixed in a radically different way than traditional republicanism or later liberalism.
Is there anything good about the few? On your view of Machiavelli?
Sure, you try to use these institutions and you try to use institutional pressure to make the few's appetite for oppression coincide with good results for the regime. And so, for instance, in the pursuit of empire, which Machiavelli thinks is necessary, empire is a necessary, but potentially you need a moderate amount of empire. But too much empire is bad. But to get that moderate amount of empire, you can put the nobles to very, very good use in leading armies. If you put their appetite to oppress the people into a mission to oppress other people's, other republics' peoples, you can actually harness some good from their acumen and from their cynicalness and their wisdom. Hmm. They have an important part to play. That's why Machiavelli prefers a Roman model where, you know, the economic elite is not only an economic elite, but is also a military elite. And that's how they contribute something good to the Republic. Whereas in Machiavelli's own Republic, the elite is predominantly an economic elite. And he thinks they contribute nothing of value to the Republic, you know. These churches and art and literature that they sponsor are just not as useful as, you know, commanding armies. That's a much better benefit that nobles can provide to a republic.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it sounds like, you know, I mean, you could apply this to the capitalist system too, that one of the criticisms sometimes of the sort of democratic populist view is that it might make us all poor, right? If we're anti the few, but Machiavelli isn't anti the few. That as you say, sort of can unleash, but then contain it through the people. That can unleash the capitalist innovation of the few, right? That could be a part of it while still having the many exert their power through these institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why the second chapter of the book on economic equality, it's, you know, Machiavelli's for a relative economic equality. It's not for absolute economic equality. And you can still, you know, I think he thought that freedom is incompatible with capitalist inequality, that you then have the wealthy are just the patrons of the poor who are the clients. And that's, they're dependent on the rich in all kinds of private ways. Whereas, as he says three times in the discourses, you know, it's a republic's task to keep the public rich, but the citizens poor. In other words, the common good, the res publica, should be wealthy. There should be lots of public funds, but there should be relatively meager private funds, such that elite citizens cannot just buy off or make clients out of poorer citizens. And that's and of course he's contrasting early Rome, where you have these proud aristocrats like, you know, Camillus or Cincinnatus, but they're not so much richer than the plebeians that they can completely control them. They're answerable, you know, Coriolanus, Camillus, Cincinnatus are accountable to the people precisely because they cannot economically control them. Whereas later on, you have these figures like Sulla and Pompey and Caesar, who, and Mark Antony and Octavian, who basically buy off whole legions of the common people. And that's a danger to aver. So in the early Roman Republic, you could make use of aristocratic ambition because you have relative equality, and you can put that to good civic use.
Yeah, I was thinking about your second chapter on the Gracchi and the agrarian reforms in the context of contemporary discussions about inequality. This is often, you know, I think it was 2016 election. This came up a couple, you know, Bernie Sanders run, discussion about inequality. What do you think a Machiavellian lesson for contemporary capitalist liberal democracy would be, following on those sort of Gracchi reform? I mean, would he call for a new kind of agrarian laws, or?
Of course. I mean, I think the point of one of the major points of the discourses, and one of the things I really wanted to draw out of in chapter two, to draw out of the discourses, is Machiavelli makes, you know, if you're looking closely, he makes it quite plain that political equality is impossible in conditions of astronomical economic inequality. It's just, it's as simple as that. And he gives you and he tells you a story in which, you know, too much empire contributes to that. That, you know, empire, you know, if Rome had maintained an empire on the Italian peninsula, it could have maintained relative socioeconomic equality among citizens who are now, you know, all the Italians and the Latins in addition to the Romans. And you could have had some kind of equilibrium between economic and political equality. But once, as he says in Book 1, Chapter 37, once the Senate, and he does say it's the Senate, once the Senate decided to send Rome's armies farther and farther away from Italy in order to accumulate wealth for themselves that they didn't have to share with the plebeians, you create this situation where economic equality runs so rampantly that even your elections and your legislative sessions are just dominated by those with the most wealth, as Machiavelli says in chapter 16 of book one, you know, that those who could entertain the people, but also those who could intimidate them with power, came to dominate the legislative and the electoral assemblies. And that sounds like contemporary politics to me. So, you know, I think Bernie Sanders is right that you can't have a democracy, you can't have political democracy if you have economic inequality, at least of a certain magnitude. And you know, I think Machiavelli was fundamentally attuned to that, and that's again something that's kind of absent from the three literatures I take on in part two of the book. This is something that Rousseau is very nervous about. It's something that Skinner and Pocock are kind of oblivious to, you know, corruption for Skinner and Pocock is not traced to equality per se, as it is for Machiavelli. It's traced to a kind of moral decay, and not a moral decay caused by an economic decay. And Strauss, of course, wants to move our eyes away from Machiavelli's critique of the wealthy.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to get to Rousseau in a second, because Rousseau is, of course, he's the pictured on the Political Theory Review iTunes icon. So I suppose I have to rise to a defense in that. but before we get there, I wanted to ask you briefly, I mean, maybe to elaborate a little bit on the chapter on the, in The Prince, on Cesare Borgia, because you make this extremely interesting case that Borgia is a kind of portrayed as a kind of Christ figure in chapter on The Prince. Can you say a little bit in the way, you know, where you find that reading, and what way he's like a Christ figure, and what the significance of that connection is?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you where it came from. I was, I was discussing with students. I was in class, and we were talking about Machiavelli's account of Cesare Borgia's career. And it's as many people know, it's the longest, more pages are devoted to Cesare Borgia than to anybody else in The Prince. And it's a really kind of riveting account of his rise and fall that Machiavelli gives. And, Cesare Borgia is this natural son, that is, illegitimate child of a pope who basically the pope helps start a military career to conquer north central Italy and, as Machiavelli says, bring peace to the Romagna, to this province north of the of Rome. And just one day, we were discussing Machiavelli's account of Borgia's career, and I said, so the Holy Father sent his son to bring peace to the people of the Romagna. And I was like, wow. Wait a minute.
Familiar.
Yeah, this sounds vaguely, as a Catholic boy, I remember a Prince of Peace sent by his Holy Father to redeem his people. And then I started looking closely at the story, and then you realize, Cesare Borgia has two names, like Jesus of Nazareth and Jesus Christ. He's Cesare Borgia, but he's also Duke Valentino. Those who follow him call him by a more exalted name rather than his actual lowborn name. Again, he started on his career by his dad. His dad sends him out to on this mission to redeem or bring peace to his people. There's this one passage where Machiavelli begins by saying Pope Alexander as the principal actor, and then he starts saying he, and then at the end of the paragraph, it's Duke Valentino. And so you have this transfiguration, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like the New Testament story of the apostles on the beach seeing Jesus transfigure into his father before their eyes, or in this case, vice versa. And Machiavelli it just becomes suddenly very playful when you see that a figure Paul, the Signor Paolo, this Mr. Paul becomes a singular piece in a singular figure in Cesare Borgia's rise, that he's the one who reconciles Cesare Borgia with his enemies, in the way that St. Paul does that for Jesus. And that, in the end, it's Cesare's, and this wasn't new, the idea that Cesare believed in forgiveness. Other people had said that there's something Christian about Cesare in the end, and that he allows a new pope to dupe him into believing he forgives Cesare's past wrongs to him. But I just found that the biblical allegory went deeper and deeper. And the point of that is to show that, for Machiavelli, there is something about Christianity that is right about how you win popular favor and how you validate popular judgment. And that in the kind of bloody spectacle that Cesare Borgia's execution of his henchman Romero turns out to be, there are sins are paid for that sins must be paid for through bloody executions. And there's something fundamentally right at the foundation of Christianity in the crucifixion and what it signifies with Machiavelli's account of how Cesare Borgia has to kind of purify the people's spirit through this execution of his henchmen that kind of alleviates everybody of their political sins. So yeah, it was just an endlessly fascinating, even since I've published reading Machiavelli, there were new things, new facets of Machiavelli's account of Cesare Borgia's career that jibed with a kind of Christological reading. And, you know, Machiavelli's trying to say that, you know, he's often saying Jesus Christ was a bad founder because he left no laws, you know, for his to rule his people. He's just like, love your neighbors and I'll be back in a few minutes, you know? And whereas Moses is a much better founder because he's mm-hmm. he's an armed prophet, he arms the people and he establishes laws. And this is, Cesare Borgia is kind of Mosaic in a certain way. He's Christological, but he's also Mosaic. Machiavelli makes a point that he starts recruiting the people to be his popular army, you know, is something in a literal sense, not in a figurative or confessional sense of his army, but an actual military legion to follow him, which is what Jesus should have done.
Yeah, so, I love the bit at the end where you say it, but you point out quite rightly that there's no body at the end. Cesare Borgia doesn't die at the end, right? So there's no body, just like there's no body at the end of Jesus' story.
Out of teaching. The students were constantly saying, you know, and Cesare dies, you know, and then he's killed and this and that. And it's like, I'm like, where do you get the idea that he's killed? He's not killed. There's nothing said. There's nothing said about his death. You go looking. I tell them, go look for the body. And they go to the tomb and the stone has been rolled away.
Right. It's almost like Machiavelli suggesting this is what Christ should have been if he were armed, or what he could have been if he were armed. Absolutely. Right. I mean,
this is what a Christian found. Look, you want to be a Christian and you want to be a political founder, you want to redeem Italy. If this book is about unifying Italy under, you know, one sword, then this is the kind of Christian you have to be. You know, this is, you have to follow Cesare Borgia's successes and you have to avoid his mistakes. And, you know, the papacy plays an important role in that. You can use the papacy's power to try to unify Italy, but then you cannot let others use the papacy's power to undermine your agenda to unify Italy.
That raises the question about religion, which I'm trying to think what your view on that is. What's your view on Machiavellian religion? Is it, you know, there's a sort of reading that Machiavelli is an atheist or wants to get rid of religion, and then there's another view that he wants to reform it. What's the role of religion in your view in the populist republic?
I mean, we'll never know the answer to that. You know, his personal belief. I mean, people, you know, there's a lot of evidence that he was, you know, deeply Lucretian in his views, so that he was a materialist at heart. There he is buried in Santa Croce. But the important thing is, I think he believes that there are theological resonances that cannot ever be eradicated from the human experience. And I think he believes, you know, as much as he excoriates Christianity, both institutionally in the church and for its doctrines in lots of ways, I think he thinks that Christianity had the most prescient insight into what the people desire, and that this desire for security and punishment for those who oppress them, and the appetite for the spectacular execution, that these things could be merged with a kind of, you know, with the pagan politics, the pagan populist politics of the ancient world could be remerged with the Christian psychology in a way that would make for an even more potent populist or democratic politics going forward. So I think he wants to harness the psychological, and of course, psychological is never not spiritual, even if spiritual doesn't always mean soul in an orthodox sense. So I think Machiavelli thinks that there is there's something useful there in Christianity, in a not simply instrumental sense, if I can be elusive.
Right, but certainly not in the hierarchical Catholic sense, the use of priests, right? Yeah, this
is no, certainly not. Certainly, religious authority has to be subject to political authority, to civic authority. Mm-hmm. No question about that. And that's why he likes the Swiss. You know, even before the Protestant Reformation, you know, these Swiss Catholics seem to be, you know, quite pious, quite free, quite equal, and quite armed. And that they are the modern ancients.
Good transition to Rousseau. Excellent.
Yes,
okay, so let me ask you about Rousseau. So you have this chapter on Rousseau, and Rousseau famously has a reading of Machiavelli as not a friend to tyrants, but he's a Republican. And Rousseau is often taken to be as a kind of gold standard of the Democrat. But you point out that, you know, there are these places in Book Four which basically nobody reads, except for you and me, I guess, and some Rousseau scholars, where Rousseau says some strange things about the Roman constitution. Particularly, you talk about chapter four when he talks about the comitia system in Rome, and how Rousseau seems to take quite a different view to Machiavelli. Machiavelli emphasizes more the democratic features, and Rousseau focuses on the oligarchic features. Do you want to say a bit more of that?
Sure.
And then I'll say what I think about it, but go ahead. Yeah.
That's fine. No. My claim there, and it's very unpopular because, you know, Rousseau, I guess, like Machiavelli, is not just a figure of scholarship. He's also a object of worship and fandom. He's very much revered, you know, as a person and not just admired as a thinker. And so people get very upset when the patron saint of modern democracy and modern egalitarianism is exposed as an oligarch, which is what he is, within large republics. I mean, chapter four, book four of The Social Contract, I would say, is a blueprint to show how the kind of sovereign democracy, and again, not necessarily governmental democracy, but sovereign democracy that can exist in a small republic, which he's describing throughout most of The Social Contract, how that would be translated in a large republic. And the only way you can translate that into a large republic is to have institutions that violate political equality. The only way you can have freedom in a republic as large as Rome or as large as contemporary France, in Rousseau's mind, is to have weighted voting for the wealthy. Because in a large republic, you're going to have economic inequality, which he doesn't like, of course. But if it's a fact of life, if economic inequality is a fact of life, then you will have a concurrent fact, and that will be the corruption of the poor. The poor will become morally corrupt, and they will become the objects of either their own imprudence, or they will become tools of nefarious men. And so therefore, if you have economic inequality and you have corruption, moral corruption of the poor, you cannot have a constitution that abides full political equality. And so Rousseau basically says, and not just the government sovereign distinction doesn't apply here. Rousseau recommends weighted voting for the wealthy in the Centuriate Assembly of Rome, where votes are astronomically weighted in favor of the rich. In fact, the poor may not even get to vote. If the rich come to a quorum on elections or on legislation, the poor don't even get to cast a vote. They're there to watch, but they're not there to even cast a vote. And so the general will in a large republic is constituted by the wealthiest citizens agreeing among themselves what legislative or electoral outcomes should be.
Yeah, so I guess part of my question, when I look back over this chapter to remind myself, because again, yeah, this is a chapter that's not quite as read, but it's an important one.
Largest chapter in the largest the largest chapter in the largest book of the social.
It's longer than the civil religion chapter, really?
I believe so.
Oh, okay. I guess the general question that I had with it is how much you think actually Rousseau is advocating the Commedia Centuriata as a kind of gold standard of what I think you used the word advocate, like to what degree you think he's actually advocating for it. Cause it might be like, look, you know, I mean, he says at the beginning of the chapter, these are kind of illustrations of my view, but it may just be
for the judicious reader.
Yes. For the judicious reader. Right. I guess I'm not the judicious. Anyway, I'm not the judicious reader,
but... or I'm not.
Yeah. So to what degree this actually, you know, measures up to, I mean, he might be, in other words, he might be advocating for it despite its flaws, which is that it's not perfect. Like if it were tweaked and we actually had equal representation, that would be better. I think what he really emphasized, the Centuriata, what he really likes about it as opposed to the Commedia Tribuna and the Commedia Curiae, which sort of weigh different parts of the state at the expense of the others, is that it's the one Commedia that's actually universal, that sort of incorporates the entire citizen body, which makes it the closest approximation to the general will, even though it might have these flaws. that's a way to think about it, to sort of save them. What do you think about that?
You know, I would say that if Rousseau, first of all, I think, you know, there are other models he could have chosen for a republic, you know, for institutions in a large republic, right? There are lots of, or he could have just cast Roman institutions in a different way, as Machiavelli did. You can just reconstruct them, which he does. He does in the case of the Tribunate. He doesn't say the Romans, you know, and again, this shows his anti-popular disposition. He doesn't like the tribunes of the plebs because they only serve the plebs, and he wants real tribunes should also serve the government against the plebs. But I think Rousseau really tips off. First of all, he says, look, this is how you construct a republic when you have as many as 500,000 citizens, right? This is what you have to do. If you have that many citizens, you're going to have institutions like these, maybe not exactly, but like these. And I think Rousseau is trying to pull the wool over the eyes of his kind of democratically inclined, the person who really cheers at the first books of the social contract and buy into equality in the way he describes it, and how sovereign authority must be absolutely, everyone must vote and it must be majority rule. He tries to trick them in his discussion of the prerogative century, right? So the Romans had this so Machiavelli, Rousseau lays out this system where, you know, the very few, it's like the American economy. The top 1% have, you know, the top 1% have, like, you know, 40% of the votes, and then the next percentage, basically the two wealthiest or the three wealthiest voting classes can decide, have a majority of centuries that they can dictate legislation and elections, and among many centuries. And so the fact that the one who gets to vote first, though, but the richest century didn't have to vote first. That was determined by lottery. So you would choose a century, and whatever class that century came from would be the first to vote. And he says, look, this is a democratic thing. This is like Athens, which I've done nothing but disparage throughout this book. Look, you know, an Athenian element here, that we use lottery to decide which century votes first, and then the other centuries will follow in line, because religiously this entitles, or this privileges the vote of this first century to guide the other centuries who vote. And he leaves out the fact that, but still, the wealthiest class has the most number of centuries that can be chosen to vote first. And so they still have this astronomical mathematic advantage in possibly voting first. And so there's where I say, okay, so now, so he's signaling to us that he is endorsing the oligarchic quality of this system, because he's precisely trying to hide its oligarchic quality by using this veneer of this facade of a democratic aspect to it. So I remain unconvinced. I think, you know, as I put in the, I'm not trying to make Rousseau into a bad guy or anything like that, but I do think Rousseau feared the poor more than he loved equality. That's how I put it in the book, and that's how I stand
by. Yeah, it could be that. I think what you said earlier, which is that as you depart from sort of rural, simple, rustic community where you can actually have equal rule, and you move towards these large, massive regimes, it just become, you know, the sort of basic principles have to be compromised more and more. I think of this in the context of the government of Poland. Whenever I teach the government of Poland, side by side with the social contract, and so they say, wait a second, we just read where Rousseau says you can't have representation or representation is bad, and then all of a sudden he's, you know, he's okay with representation in Poland. It could just be, well, look, as you develop a big regime, these principles need to be compromised for the sake of stability.
Well, I think that would be fine if he weren't so disparaging of Athens. Mm-hmm. You know, if he could find mm-hmm. something good to say about Athenian democracy, then I could be open to that. But it's really the combination of lionizing the most oligarchic aspects of Rome and criticizing the most democratic aspects of Athens that just leads me to believe that, you know, he just refuses to countenance democracy on a large scale. That it can only be in a republic the size of a Swiss canton or something like that, or Venice. You really can't have equality, political equality, in a large regime. You have to kind of the poor are just too vulnerable to corruption and then to bad judgment, and so you have to, as much as he doesn't love the Roman aristocracy, but he thinks good judgment is more likely to be found among them than among the Roman plebeians, which is exactly the inversion of Machiavelli's evaluation of the Roman nobles and the Roman plebs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's a great reading. Machiavelli's more democratic than Rousseau. It's fabulous. I want to close off by talking generally about populism, if that's okay.
Sure.
We had, I had on Bill Galston last, who talked about all the things that are wrong with populism and how it's leading to a crisis of liberal democracy. I did push him on the difference between left and right forms of populism, though, and he did admit that he's more concerned about right leaning forms of populism.
Right.
What do you think about this as a sort of general phenomenon in the West, that the sort of liberalism seems to be in crisis, populism seems to be on the rise, and maybe we should have some reason to be concerned about populism. Why should we, it seems under your view, advocate for more populism?
Oh, I think we have no choice but to advocate for more populism, and it has to be a progressive form of populism, and it has to be a populism Bernie Sanders puts it well. I mean, you can't, since we cannot have under the present system democracy, you can't have democracy when there's such disproportionate influence of wealth over the political system. There has to be a mass movement to basically change that state of affairs, and I would say institutionally change that state of affairs. And I think there needs to be a movement to make the United States Constitution more majoritarian. I think that has to be a rallying cry. I think you can't have, we're increasingly moving to minoritarian rule in the United States, geographical minoritarian rule, but what worries me more, plutocratic minoritarian rule. And so I think people have to get mobilized by the idea that politics is not their own, government is not their own, and their votes don't count, either because of economic influence in elections or because of institutional structures that disempower minorities. And I think that that's something that that's a, you know, a populist, one way you can tell whether a movement is populist in a progressive or a reactionary way, I would say, is if it sets as its goals the establishment of institutions where the people rule each other more democratically, more directly. And if, you know, they're just going to empower some charismatic leader or some party, you know, to be mean to immigrants on their behalf, well, then that's not a that's not a populism I want to be associated. That's not a progressive populism, but it is a form of populism. I will acknowledge that.
So what's to keep it from being that that bad form of populism?
You're reading Machiavelli properly, arousing a kind of an anti-elitist orientation among people, and that anti-elitism should be really angry, fostering a kind of anger against the vast amount of economic inequality in the United States. Number one, just on its own, it's a bad thing, but it's a doubly bad thing because it also creates political inequality, and we're not even in a situation like Athens at its best, where there was, you know, there was vast economic inequality, but there was genuine political equality. And we need to, as a first step, at least restore that situation where there can be political equality, and then citizens as equal can decide the laws and elect the officials that they want, that most people, that the majority of people want. And then through those policies, we need to think politically about the kind of economic relationships we want to have in this country.
Yeah, I think in my less democratic populist moments, I become worried about the sort of class conflict that might emerge. But then again, then I rethink this and think, well, we already have a massive conflict in the United States, a sort of polarization between the left and the right, and maybe something like this form of democratic populism actually can unite, say, Republican blue collar workers and democratic progressives, you know, against the elite. Maybe that would be a better, more productive form of conflict than the kind of partisan tribalism that we have today.
Right, exactly. Rather than a political conflict, a real social conflict. And, you know, I think, you know, Machiavelli had great insight. You know, I don't often affiliate Machiavelli with David Brooks, but they both identify plebeians as the working class does not want the wealth of the wealth. They do not want the wealthy's riches. They're not upset with inequality per se. They are upset when economic inequality is used, or as Machiavelli puts it, when the wealthy use their riches incorrectly. And that is as part of their efforts to dominate poorer citizens. Then they get upset. So it's, you know, they're not, you know, the disposition, the humor not to be oppressed is not a call to communism. It's not a call to kind of complete appropriation of the wealthy's riches. It's about, as the Gracchi's very reformist, very moderate agenda was, a kind of redistribution that is will restore a relative economic equality that can make civic liberty and political equality possible. That's what the agenda has to be. There's, you know, it's always exaggerated. You know, another, well, this is where David Brooks and Machiavelli part ways. You know, Machiavelli goes out of his way to show that the nobles always resort to greater violence in protecting their wealth than the people resort to in trying to take it away from them. So he and I are inclined to say, don't be worried about unleashing these forces of economic egalitarianism and anti-elitism. I mean, just again, going back to the Florentine histories, despite his evaluations on the surface of how outraged he is at the behavior of the Ciompi, the wool workers in their revolt in Florence, at the level of what they did, Machiavelli shows that they were incredibly moderate in their behavior and in their demands. And I think we can afford a little more animosity and a little more agitation on the part of working people and poor people against wealthier citizens in this country. I don't think it would wreck this country to have a little more class animosity.
Right. Certainly shift that animosity from where it's being directed towards, say, the caravan, towards
that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to end. And let me say, this was a lot of fun, John, and I appreciated you taking the time to join me on the Political Theory Review.
Jeff, thank you. I mean, it's an honor to be here. I'm so happy you thought my book worthy enough to have a discussion over. So thank you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.